Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, and my co-host, Felicity Signal-Reed. Each week at this time, we introduce you to people from around Northumberland involved with the world of books and writing. This week is a special week for our program. Word on the Hills celebrates its first anniversary. Last year, on February 9th, 2014, the first episode of Word on the Hills aired on Northumberland 89.7. Felicity and I were two new and very nervous hosts, starting a project that we hoped would raise the profile of the wonderful writing and publishing talent that we have in this region. And here we are, 1 year later, 52 programs later, a little less nervous, a little more experienced, and definitely awed by the range of guests we have had on the show over the last year and the amazing work that they do. We don't have a guest today. Instead, we thought we would look back on Word on the Hill's first year and bring you some of its highlights. Felicity, perhaps you can remind listeners of how this all started.
Well, it all started with Barry Walker coming to talk to the Spirit of the Hills Writers Group, talking about small town radio and saying that they were looking for programs. So we decided that we would make a proposal. And we did. We came in, as Gwyn says, all nervous and got lots of help and support at the studio. There were a few challenges, of course, to overcome. Isn't that so, Gwyn?
Indeed, because when we first started, small town radio, as it was then, had a technician to help us record and so on. So we essentially showed up and did the interview and went home. Then that all changed because this is a volunteer radio station, and our very nice technician Nathan got a full-time job, and so we arrived one day to do an interview to find that there was nobody to do the technical side, and we had interviewees lined up, so we bit the bullet and said, well, okay, show us which buttons to push and we'll go from there. And so that's what we did, and Felicity and I have had a really interesting learning curve over the year, but we now record all the shows ourselves, and we edit them too, convert them for our website and so on.
And we've developed our own roles in the production of the program. I do the finding and inviting of the guests. We share the hosting. Gwyn does the editing, and I maintain the website. Now, the website has been a great deal of fun. It was set up for us by Jessica Outram. So thank you, Jessica. Now I can push the right buttons and upload all our programs to the website where they're archived, and you can listen anytime from anywhere to any program you choose. So we always hope that lots of people will do that, because of course not everybody's got free at 1 o'clock on Sunday.
No, and we would hope too that you would go there not just to listen to the programs that you missed, but you can leave us comments there and so on. And we've had a few over the year that have been very encouraging.
Yes. We've had an amazing range of visitors over the year. So we have 21 novelists, 15 poets, 22 short fiction writers, one playwright, 9 biographers, non-fiction writers and journalists, 5 memoirists, 3 publishers and a number of self-publishers, 3 editors, and 8 writing teachers.
That's quite the mix, isn't it?
It is. It is.
What were some of your favourites?
You know, it's really difficult to pick them out because we've had so many wonderful people with us. But I've enjoyed the poets because they all have their own very personal way of approaching writing poetry. And, of course, they write very different kinds of poetry. So we've had Richard Green, Deb Panko, Ted Amsden, Mark Clement, Bruce Kaufman, all with very different ideas about how poetry has come to them.
Let's just listen to one or two of their poems.
Yes, that would be good.
So this one, I can't remember quite where I started, but it ended up being rhyming couplets. It's called Yes. And it's in response to Wild Nights by Emily Dickinson. Dear Emily advises, in a paradox of surprises, that for passion to be felt, one can only melt into the unknown, the unmeasured, or into another who is treasured. For to be unbound in nightly dreams is to be found by life, it seems.
In the final poem from that collection is called Solitude. Solitude took the brush from my fingers and painted the color of its night on the back of my hand. I could smell her breath of roses and could taste the blood on her thorn. And there was a passionate fire in her eyes, neither anger nor lust. And she told me of a time when there was no poetry, nothing symbolic, no canvas or brush or back of a wrist, and a time when all things carried but their own face, and of a time of everything walking backward and with all their eyes closed.
Corrections. My friend works medium security and says of his mad charges, you can't be angry, they're sick, shouldn't be here. To the near sane, he doles punishments when fuck you, screw, is prelude to a shank, some soup spoon snatched and ground against the whetstone of the bars, a razor blade bound into a pencil's eraser tip, or merely the handle of a toothbrush made murder one sharp. And stranger things. Back in stir after his biopsy, a man threatened to force a pen through the incision and crush his liver unless given Tylenol 3. He settled for extra strength and the promise of a doctor. I was just joking, he added meekly, knowing threats of self-harm bring sanctions too, days apart in an observation cell, diaper clad, and deprived of anything imagination could turn into a noose.
Okay, so here's a simple one I wrote about coming through the doors of Victoria Hall, and it's called When Last Through These Doors. Wonder-filled, camera-clad, what little thoughts I had. There were greetings, the town crier in blue with his yellow clapper, mirrors laughing, people chatting, smiles pulled me in. When last through these doors, party frilled the prom-growers, boys to men in their preset ties, daughters as women with roaring eyes, carried me forward. When last through these doors, the petty-faced and smiling thieves, their walk of grief with counsel, towards stern judges, shook me. When last through these doors, I burst. Those who tend and mend, twirl and decorate, animate, educate, gathered round me with artful ceremony. When last through these doors, seeking, needing, my place in a civic sense of things unsure, these doors opened heavily, but easily, when last through these doors.
And what about you, Gwyn?
Well, I really enjoy fiction, and I've also been really moved by some of the memoir pieces that we've heard. In particular, two that really stick in my mind was an interview we had with Diane Taylor. She read a piece about writing a letter to her father, and I thought to myself, it's the kind of thing we should probably all try in our lives. And here's just a little piece from that.
On the occasion of my father's 77th birthday, I wanted to do something especially meaningful for him. Who knew how many more birthdays he would have? And at the time, Dad and I were not seeing eye to eye. I decided to write him a long thank you letter for all the things, material and of the spirit, that he had given me over the years. I bought a new pen. I bought special paper, yellow because that was his favorite color. I sat and thought. I wrote, thank you. I looked out the window at the tumbling yellow maple leaves, my mind a blank. I didn't know it was going to be this difficult. I wrote, thank you for giving me your love of words. A few memories had come to me about the stories he used to tell with great Irish gusto. I wrote, thank you for the leather briefcase my first year teaching. I still have it and keep special things in it. I wrote surprisingly little in the hour I had set aside, just those two things. The next night I set aside the same hour and sat with the same yellow paper at the same desk and picked up the same pen. I pulled my mind away from the day into the space I had created for my father. I wrote down three more things: teaching me to drive, to plant a tree, to not fear thunder. It felt like opening a door to a room I seldom visited and peering in. There was an excitement to bringing dormant images to life. I saw him drying my long red hair on Sunday afternoons with that pink hairdryer, singing in his off-key voice when I played Christmas carols. working all those years at a job he didn't like to support his family. I filled up page 1, page 2, page 3, each with about 25 gifts, then filled up pages 4 and 5. Before I knew it, his birthday was upon me, and I had to quickly finish the letter. I folded my work and placed it inside the card. Dad was no longer as quick as he once was. I wondered what his response would be. Silently, he read through them all. Then he looked up, his gravelly voice carefully enunciating, "It's all here."
Another piece that moved me was a piece from Heidi Kruet. She is new to fiction writing. She's actually a commercial writer, writing for business and all those kind of things. But she's been delving into the world of fiction and has tried a method called freefall writing. And the piece that came out of her freefall, she read for us. I think what made it special for me was how honest and how detailed she was about it. So here's a little piece from what she shared about her opa.
Those who live life soaring from peak to peak have a pitiable distance to fall. My opa was a giant among men, rakishly handsome, charismatic, with his thick black hair, one lock careless on his forehead, Elvis Presley mouth, blue eyes. Born in 1900 in Frankfurt, Germany, and emigrating to Canada by ship when he was 30, he had everything it took to survive as the Great Depression took its toll on families everywhere. He ate in soup kitchens in the beginning, eventually doing odd jobs as gardener, chauffeur, handyman, before finding work as a chef in the Royal Muskoka Hotel and then the Royal York Hotel in Toronto. He bought a farm in Freeman before showing an aptitude as a prospector, discovering gold mines in northeastern Ontario and eventually the world's largest nickel mine in Brazil, never developed because of its inaccessible location. The former Canadian mining company, Inco, was one of his partners, and the former Governor General Rolly Michener, one of his supporters and devoted fans. This was the man who sat on the toilet in front of me that day. This was the conqueror felled by malicious, invisible sorcerers at work in his brain, snipping, snipping, with their indiscriminate scissors, carving out vast and precious webs of memory, rewiring language, setting up impenetrable barriers preventing access to identity, dignity, self-esteem. But they forgot to dismantle the music. Opera had always been a mainstay of Opa's life, manifesting in a sacred ritual every Saturday afternoon when he would turn on the radio and listen to the Metropolitan Opera's live broadcast. One of the four children for whom that ritual became equally important was my mother. When she visited her father at Kennedy Lodge, she would play tapes of the operas he loved best. The effect was instantaneous, organic. The music rushed like a flood of warm milk through the ruined city of his mind, providing comfort, filling spaces, offering a touchstone, a place he recognized and loved. And the film over his eyes would clear and he would smile and sing, brandishing his hands as if he were a conductor, sitting on his pedestal in the orchestra pit, raising his baton, his daughter, his audience of one, her eyes shining, giving him no reason to doubt his undiminished power to lead.
We'll have more after this short break.